are listening to The Addiction Files, where we discuss evidence-based treatment, clinical pearls, and resources while striving to destigmatize the treatment of addiction in our medical culture and save lives. We are the addiction doctors, Dr. Darlene Peterson and Paula Cook.
Welcome to The Addiction Files. We are thrilled to have Dr. Mason Turner back joining us to discuss depression and substance use disorders. And this is a fascinating topic. And thank you so much, Dr. Turner, for coming back to discuss this with us. I'm going to turn it over to you to introduce or reintroduce yourself, I should say, and then we'll get started. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And thank you for having me here again. I look forward to our discussion today around depression and substance use disorders. So I'm Mason Turner. I'm the Associate Chief Medical Officer for Behavioral Health for Intermountain Health. And I'm a psychiatrist and addiction medicine physician.
Thank you. Well, Mason, I mean, there's even a lot more there. We just got done talking about your amazing trip to Australia, which sounds pretty awesome. First, like Mason, tell us a little bit about what the different types of depression are and give us just a brief primer on that and some of the criteria that we should be using to diagnose depression.
Absolutely. And I think it's very important to know that depression is a symptom that we describe. It describes a type of mood symptom or a way that we might feel and express our mood. But depressed mood and related symptoms actually have many, many different causes and have also many different diagnoses. And it is important to be aware of what some of those diagnoses are and some of the differences that, as a professional, I would be asking a patient to understand a little bit more around their depression, how it shows up, what those diagnoses are, because that's important for treatment purposes as well. And we think about the overlay with substance use disorders, it becomes even more important so that we can understand what it is that we're treating and select the appropriate interventions. So the most common type of depression, beyond just what we call reactive depression, so feeling a bit depressed about life circumstances or other issues that may come up, the most common form of depression is actually major depressive disorder. It does affect about 10% of people at any given time. And if we look at it over the lifetime, probably close to 25% of people have had a major depressive episode at some point in their lifetimes. It's also important to know that major depressive disorder is one of the leading causes of suffering in the world. Disability, morbidity, as we would say in medicine, it's really important to know that that is one of the chief causes of functional problems in our lives for people throughout the world. And so we have very effective treatments for depression. And so it's really important as we talk about these diagnoses, if this sounds like you, or you have a friend or a family member who has a depression that you think needs to be evaluated, please see a professional, talk about those symptoms, really discuss what's going on, because we have very effective and safe treatments for you if you do have a major depressive disorder or one of these other depressive disorders. So major depressive disorder is characterized by episodes of depression. The episodes can be as short as 2 weeks, or they can be as long as months or even years in some cases. Typically, depression episodes will last about 6 months, and they're accompanied with depressed mood along with a variety of physical symptoms. So problems sleeping. You may have issues with your appetite, weight gain or weight loss that's not intentional. Feeling more sped up or slowed down than usual. Some of the other symptoms that we notice can be some physical symptoms, body aches and other things along those lines. But the most prominent symptom we see with these episodes is what we call anhedonia. So really not being able to get pleasure out of activities or that used to bring you a great deal of pleasure. Maybe having difficulties getting motivated even to get out of bed or to leave your house. And so these are some of the very common symptoms that we see with major depressive episodes. But again, very important to recognize that these are episodic, meaning they start and they end, and they may or may not recur later on in life, but they can be very, very damaging during the period of time you have those symptoms and cause a lot of distress and a lot of functional problems. And that, again, is the most common form of depression. We also have other forms of depression that we want to think about, one of which is called adjustment disorder with depressed mood, or it can also have anxiety as well. And this is basically you've had a life event that has occurred, maybe a divorce, a loss of a job, something along those lines, really very difficult to process. It could even be the death of a child. It could be a traumatic event even can trigger these kinds of episodes. And what is typically kind of quote-unquote normal reactive depression, feeling depressed about that event in a very expected way, can then begin to take a life of its own and become a depressive episode of sorts that we describe as an adjustment disorder. and extremely common. And sometimes those adjustment disorders will actually evolve into a major depressive episode as well.
So can you differentiate, Dr. Turner, how as a clinician, do you differentiate a major depressive episode from an adjustment disorder? Other than obviously there's some kind of an event that triggers an adjustment disorder, but how do you determine the difference between the two? Or for example, when the adjustment disorder becomes a depressive episode?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think, first of all, the first thing I'm looking for to make that differentiation is what has been going on in your life. Did you notice there was an event that triggered the depression? Because for an adjustment disorder, you have to be able to link an event with the onset of depression. Now, sometimes actually we will have an evaluation with a patient, have a conversation, and we may say, well, that event to me doesn't seem like it was significant enough to actually cause a depressive episode. That is not one of the criteria. We don't have to assess the level of trauma or the level of severity of an event to see whether it causes depression. It really is, are those two things linked together? The majority of major depressive episodes for most people do not have triggers. There may be some stress in someone's life, or there may be other things going on that may predispose someone to that episode. But most patients would tell me, you know, really, there's nothing I can point to that started the depression. It just kind of was there, and then it continued and got worse and worse and worse. So those are kind of the two ways I might think about differentiating those two.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you. And what about remission? You said most episodes last about 6 months, although that is highly variable. Do most episodes remit spontaneously in the absence of treatment, or do they persist if people do not receive treatment?
So also another great question, and really goes to why oftentimes people don't seek treatment for depression. So in theory, and according to the diagnostic criteria that we use, major depressive episodes typically will remit spontaneously. But if we look at that onset and then the length of time someone has that episode, again, highly variable. Again, most severe forms of depression will be months with an episode, but they can be much shorter than that or longer. And so one of the things we're really looking at in these episodes, they do remit spontaneously, but the majority of patients who have one episode of depression will have a second one. And so oftentimes when I have a conversation with someone who says, hey, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, I had this episode of depression. It was pretty severe. You know, I feel okay now. We may actually decide not to initiate any treatment right now because the person feels okay. But I will tell them to monitor their symptoms carefully, go over what to look for, and then we can have the discussion if one of those episodes does recur. One of the interesting issues with a lot of psychiatric illnesses and a lot of mental health concerns is that as an individual, we may not be able to describe what's happening. We may not even understand or know that we're actually in a situation that can be treated and that is a depressive episode. So oftentimes, a lot of the education initially is around what to look for. What are some of the issues that I would want someone paying attention to? Are you sleeping 10, 12 hours and still feel very tired? Do you find that you really would prefer to sit and watch TV rather than see your friends or family members? Things along those lines to really help people identify those early signs of depression.
That's great. That's really helpful. Any other different types? I mean, do we ever would use the term the cyclothymia? What would you call those? And then looping in postpartum depression.
Yeah, so there's actually a couple of other types I would want everyone to know about. And one of them is something called persistent depressive disorder. Now, persistent depressive disorder is a long-term, difficult-to-treat depressive illness, but fortunately, it's usually quite mild. People describe it as being more bothersome, that they feel like they have a negative or pessimistic outlook on life that they can't seem to shake. And by diagnostic criteria, it's a low-grade depression with very few physical symptoms that goes on for at least 2 years or more. And the vast majority of times with a persistent depressive disorder, what we see is these symptoms go on for years and years and years. Very infrequently comes to the attention of a psychiatrist or a physician or another provider because the symptoms really don't cause a lot of functional impairment, but they do cause significant distress. You can, on top of the persistent depressive disorder, however, have major depressive episodes which overlay that, and that becomes a really, really severe form of depression that we do want to aggressively treat that because that does have a lot of different issues for people when they have that type of depression. You mentioned postpartum depression, and I would also throw in with that conversation a premenstrual dysphoric disorder, two other depressive illnesses that are related to hormones, actually, in the case of PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Again, it tends to be very episodic. In the case of PMDD, it lasts about 2 weeks, usually in the latter half of the menstrual cycle. and then does tend to spontaneously remit at the end of the menstrual cycle. However, it can be a pretty rough couple of weeks, and we have extremely good treatments for this particular depressive illness, as we do for postpartum depression as well, which is onset of depression in the first year after delivery. I should add, with postpartum depression, we hear a lot about postpartum depression, as we should. Again, very, very effective treatments that we can start, even if you're breastfeeding or any kind of situation you find yourself in with your new baby, we can actually recommend treatments for you. However, we also see a significant increase in major depressive episodes in that postpartum period as well, which requires a different type of treatment too. So we have those two different types of postpartum depression. And then finally, I would add that major depressive episodes that I described initially, those can also be part of a bipolar 1 or bipolar 2 disorder. So again, very important to be aware of that. That's a much less frequent diagnosis. It only occurs in about 1% to 2% of the population. And again, it's something that we do actually look for in our evaluations for major depressive episodes as well. You mentioned cyclothymia, which is an interesting diagnosis. Cyclothymia is that persistent depressive disorder state mixed with what we call hyperthymia, or kind of a, I wouldn't say that you feel overly happy necessarily, but you may have a sense of like an elevated mood a bit. You may be engaging in more what we call goal-directed activities. You're able to get more stuff done. People usually love like a kind of a hyperthymic state, but it does cycle in with those depressive episodes that can be, you know, quite uncomfortable. And we have some interesting and excellent treatments for that as well. Medications don't help much with that, but we do have some psychotherapy approaches and other ways of kind of regulating your circadian rhythms that will help with that too.
Thank you. That was great. Now, coming to looking at how does depression with substance use disorder tie in? And so let's look at some of the epidemiology around that. How common and what comes first? And how do we differentiate those out?
Yes. And I would say that I think in terms of the actual comorbidity itself, we don't have exceptionally good data around this, but we do know this highly comorbid is the term that we would use. And I use the word comorbid instead of co-occurring. And the reason why is because we know that particularly with depression, when you have depression and a substance use disorder, treatment difficulties and the impact on your life and everything else that it goes along with that, the severity of the illness is much greater than either added together. So they actually, one makes the other worse, if that makes sense. And so when we think about comorbidities with depression and substance use disorders, there's a lot to unpack there because we also know that substances have direct effects in causing depression. Looking at the totality of the population, the vast majority of depressive episodes start before one starts to use substances. So when we try to diagnose and differentiate the two and what's the chicken or the egg, which came first, we actually have a lot of data around depression. Typically, if we go back to adolescence, we go back to young adulthood, perhaps before substances were initiated, but not always. And this is a particularly difficult diagnostic differentiation to make, because in the first 30 days of abstinence, oftentimes people feel very depressed. They look like they have a major depressive episode. So again, the epidemiology is a little mixed in terms of what is that true comorbidity. We know that it's high, and probably we would say between 30 to 50% of people with a substance use disorder will report some type of depression either during their substance use or in that immediate abstinence period. So again, very, very common. And we do also see a bidirectional relationship. The presence of depression increases the risk of substance use disorder, and the reverse is true as well. The presence of substance use disorders does increase the risk of depression. This is particularly true in adolescents. In adolescents and young adults, with onset of depression, that's the first symptom that occurs, they're at a much higher risk of developing a substance use disorder down the road.
That's interesting, and we see all of that play out clinically, for sure. So in terms of the clinical approach, then, if we are treating people with substance use disorder, tell us the approach that is most appropriate in terms of treating depression with or without a preceding documented or historic depressive history.
Yeah, so the first place I start is really looking at the depression and the associated symptoms that may go along with that to give me some window into really what is that depressive episode look like, and what is the diagnosis that potentially that we need to treat, right? So going back to that description of the various types of depression, I really want to take as thorough a history as I possibly can around what was going on prior to the initiation of substance use, or the acceleration of it, or the development of a disorder. Someone who tells me, you know, I had a little bit of alcohol at age 13, didn't really drink much until I was, you know, 22, really developed a disorder in my 30s, I can still really make a good diagnosis of a depressive disorder if I know when the depressive symptoms came on. So you don't have to necessarily look for those symptoms prior to the onset of substance use. We're really looking at the pattern of how their use has progressed over time relative to their depression as well. So that's kind of the first piece that I really want to look at. If they've ever been on antidepressants before, and there's been a documented diagnosis of major depressive disorder, or have a high likelihood that they had a major depressive episode, I will go ahead and treat. These are extremely safe medications, and it really is okay to go ahead and treat if you don't have the diagnosis exact at that moment. With one caveat that I always mention to clinicians and to patients as well, you really want to think about the bipolar diagnoses, particularly bipolar 1. Now, fortunately, bipolar 1, which is characterized by mania, and then you may or may not have major depressive episodes, typically you will, but it's not required for the diagnosis. Bipolar 1 is pretty easy to spot. Bipolar 1, heavily comorbid with substance use disorders, and usually we have a really good history of hospitalizations. The mania tends to drive a lot of functional problems and other issues that we can usually get that by history. The one that's a little more difficult to sort out is bipolar 2 disorder, which is a major depressive episode with that hyperthymia or hypomania as well that we talked about a bit earlier. That actually is okay if we kind of miss that diagnosis initially. We're not really going to do a lot of harm by introducing an antidepressant relatively early on in treatment, unlike bipolar 1, where actually we can worsen the course. So fortunately, we can usually make the diagnosis and we can rule out the bipolar 1 and really look at that depressive episode and begin treatment.
That's excellent.
That's like just quick, you touched on this, but when you're looking at like post-acute withdrawal versus like depression symptoms, when you're talking about it's difficult sometimes to diagnose if you don't have some of these great histories, how do we just say this is still some of their consequences of use or some of their withdrawal syndrome?
I would say the majority of the time, if we're looking at a post-acute withdrawal syndrome or really just an early abstinence in general, even if we don't have a lot of withdrawal symptoms to work with, what we tend to see is that someone comes in on what I would say is day zero, so their last day of use, day one, their first day of abstinence, they come in and they feel terrible, right? So they may look very much like they have a major depressive episode. They really feel terrible. We come up with a treatment plan to address their substance use disorder. And what we see over the first 30 days and over the first 3 months in particular, we see an improvement in those mood symptoms if they were related to their use of substance, in direct action of the substance, or post-acute withdrawal. We see an improvement over 30 days to 3 months in their symptoms. The reverse is true if we're really looking at a major depressive episode. So if I see someone who is drinking very heavily, comes in to treat their alcohol use disorder, and they are depressed and they stop drinking, oftentimes what we see is a worsening of the depression over the next 3 months, and that really cinches the diagnosis for me. You would not see a worsening of those symptoms in the first 30 to 90 days if indeed that was related to the substance. That is just not the way this usually presents. Now, I will give a caveat because many people who trained kind of in my era, my generation of trainees, may have learned at some point you need 30 days of quote unquote sobriety before you initiate any kind of medications. That has been disproven over and over again. Well, we can actually look at these curves and we can think about really what is the most likely diagnosis. We can also start treatment on day one without really having to worry about some of those negative consequences. So again, treat with a low suspicion while you're trying to sort out the diagnosis.
That sounds great. And would you do the same about like depression with psychosis when you have stimulant use disorder history?
Yeah, so this is actually one of the more difficult diagnoses to sort out for several reasons. One of them, if we look at kind of, let's just call this a best case scenario, although it's not really the best case, but I'll use that term to just say like the easiest way we can diagnose and differentiate these two is when we have someone who is very clear psychosis when they're using a stimulant, and it ends as soon as they're recovered from the use of the stimulant. That's relatively straightforward. Typically, we can get those timestamps, we can mark it, we can figure out, okay, they're still psychotic 3 days after using meth. This begins to raise my suspicion. There's an underlying psychotic disorder. I just need to figure out which one it is. Is it depression with psychosis? Is it an underlying primary psychotic disorder? And so forth. And I would say most, I wouldn't say the vast majority, but most patients with a stimulant-induced psychosis will have that picture. Psychotic only when they're using, or maybe a little bit into the initial recovery after they stop. Increasingly, what we see, particularly with methamphetamine, is you see a protracted psychosis that goes on for days or weeks after they stop using, in some cases, months to years after they stop using. And in those cases, we treat with antipsychotics regardless, right? We're going to use antipsychotics to treat those conditions regardless of the source and the cause. And over time, I can then begin to understand a little bit more about the nature of that psychotic illness. Is it accompanied with a lot of functional impairments, inability to work, inability to engage in relationships? It looks more like a primary psychotic disorder, a really, really protracted substance-induced psychosis. Do we see a cycling and an episodic nature of the psychosis more consistent with a mood disorder, depression, or bipolar with a psychotic illness on top of that? So we begin to get a little more character about the psychosis. But again, my usual approach is to say, you know, I really can't tell. I really, unless I've got a really good history prior to initiation of use, I really can't tell. But I know what treatment will work regardless of what the diagnosis is. And we kind of proceed with that in mind.
Oh, that's really helpful. Is there anyone that we see a higher prevalence of depression with substance use disorder? So do you see a higher rate with alcohol versus opiate use disorder or stimulant use disorder?
It's a very interesting question. And this has been looked at somewhat extensively with mixed findings, as many things in our field of addiction medicine come in with mixed findings. I will say in general, there is a, I'll call it a myth. It's not exactly a myth, but it's kind of a misunderstanding of the way alcohol works. We know that alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. It actually lessens the amount of firing that's going on in your brain, among all those neurons in your brain. However, alcohol itself doesn't necessarily create more depression than, say, cocaine or methamphetamine, which actually have direct action when you're in the kind of recovery phase of using cocaine or methamphetamine. You actually have very little dopamine in your brain. And that actually looks very much like a major depressive episode. So again, we see some after effects that are associated with stimulants. We see after effects associated with, say, MDMA, which depletes your brain of serotonin for about 7 days. So you'll see a major depressive episode in those cases. And then we do have this persistent idea that alcohol causes depression or worsens depression outcomes. Really, that has not been borne out in the literature. So any substance can really be associated with increased depression risk. There are some, again, that are more common in terms of substance-induced depression. Those would be your cocaine, methamphetamine, MDMA. But even alcohol can give you a pretty severe substance-induced depression as well.
That's great. Thank you. Let's talk about then treatment options. I'm going to just start with major depression treatment options, and then we can talk about some of the other different nuances involved with some of the different types.
Yeah, I think major depressive disorder, the treatments we have for major depression have really become refined and much more nuanced over the years. And really, when we think about a treatment plan for treating major depressive disorder, the first question that I really have to answer for the patient sitting across from me is, how severe is the depression? What was the most severe time that you had depression? How do we rate that level of severity? Because the treatment tracks along with the severity. If I have mild major depressive disorder, then really the treatment of choice is self-help plus light touch psychotherapy, so very brief psychotherapy. And in fact, many people with mild major depressive disorder do really well with self-help approaches, including exercise, nutrition, making sure they have good sleep-wake cycles, that they're managing their stress, things of that nature will really work pretty well for mild major depressive disorder. As we then move up the spectrum into what I call mildly moderate major depressive disorder, evidence-based psychotherapies and skills-based psychotherapies in particular, like cognitive behavioral therapy, really do lead the pack in terms of how we should treat that particular level of severity. Now, unfortunately, for many people, they don't have access to really good, high-quality psychotherapy. And so what happens, they go in and they see their physician, who correctly identifies a major depressive disorder and prescribes medications. What we actually know about medications in that particular category of depression, they work a little bit, but actually evidence-based psychotherapy works a lot better to get people into ongoing long-term remission and not having any more of those major depressive episodes. And again, now we have a lot of different options for cognitive behavioral therapy, whether it's virtual teletherapy, whether it's kind of enhanced self-help approaches within some of the apps that we use and recommend. So we have a variety of different ways to actually access that content for that particular group of patients. As you then move into the more severely moderate major depressive disorder, that's really where meds begin to really, they're about equal with psychotherapy at that stage, but they are really indicated if a patient wishes to go that route. And typically I would give the patient the choice. Do you want to try medication in this case? It does take about 1 to 2 months for those medications to start working. So again, we have that conversation and the limitations of medications in that context. But then we also talk about the role of psychotherapy with those patients as well. And then finally, as we cross into more severe forms of depression, that's really where medication interventions are really required. And if we look at that category a little bit further, oftentimes those individuals will have multiple episodes of depression throughout their lives. Oftentimes the recovery between episodes is very short. And so many times we're actually having to get very creative about how we approach that. What medications are we using? What combinations of medications? And that's really where treatments like ketamine, electroconvulsive therapy, transcranial magnetic stimulation, some of these other therapies really come into play with that group as well.
Can you talk specifically, you mentioned there are two specific treatments for maybe antepartum and then postpartum depression. Would you just talk about that briefly?
Yes, and thank you for raising that, because this is actually an area where this is very different. The treatment for those conditions is very different than major depressive disorder in certain key important ways. So first, I'll talk a bit about premenstrual dysphoric disorder. What's interesting about that condition is it responds almost immediately to serotonin antidepressants. So think your Prozac, your Paxil, Lexapro, Celexa, medications like that. I've actually seen women with premenstrual dysphoric disorder that have suffered for years take one dose of Prozac and then they're done. And they just do that every 2 weeks when they feel the onset of the symptoms. They take the medication for a couple of weeks, and then they don't take it the rest of the month. So very, very effective and quick treatment. True postpartum depression, so again, initial onset of depression in that postpartum period, also responds very well to medication management as well. And so we really do recommend medications with that group because of the rapid response and really the complete response that many women get with the postpartum depression and serotonin medications. I will say, many, if not most women that I treat, because I'm a psychiatrist, actually have major depressive disorder with a worsening in the postpartum period. That's a more difficult condition to treat, unfortunately.
Well, this is kind of a little bit tangential, but when would you choose an SSRI versus an SNRI, except for when someone clearly has like a comorbid pain condition? But when you're sitting across from someone and you wanted to choose a drug from one of those categories, what are some of the decisions you make in your head about that?
Yes, with a caveat, if you ask this question to 5 psychiatrists, you would get 10 different opinions. I'll move forward and give you some ideas about how I usually approach this question. So if we look at SSRIs, so selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, those primarily, but not exclusively, by the way, but primarily target serotonin reuptake. So what happens with these medications is there's more serotonin in those spaces between neurons to actually act and propagate a signal with those neurons, and actually increases what we call the tone of the neuron and the tone of the signal. That is primarily serotonin. Some of them, like Prozac, have maybe 3 or 4 other neurotransmitters, whereas others like Lexapro are pretty much only serotonin. But primarily, those are our first-line treatments for depression when we use medications. SNRIs, or serotonin norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, which are 2 of the 3 most important neurotransmitters when we think about depression treatment, those are exceptionally good treatments, very effective. They also carry more side effects. So most people, we start with the SSRIs, try maybe 2 or at most 3 of those, and then move on to an SNRI because of side effect and tolerability concerns. That's typically how most patients will approach it. SNRIs also usually take a little bit longer to start working. It can be upwards of even 3 months to get full effects from that. So again, that's another deciding factor for any patients as well. SSRI is more like 4 to 6 weeks. Very important, whoever's listening to this, whether you've experienced taking SSRIs or whether you prescribe them, very, very important to have a titration protocol to increase those medications to the maximally tolerated dose to make sure they don't work before you switch. Oftentimes what happens, I'll see a patient who's been on, say, 3 SSRIs, but at very low dosages, and we don't know, would that patient have responded to a medium or a high dose, or truly did that medication not work for them? So again, really run those doses up to the maximum dose that you can, and then really pull back and then change it if you need to.
Any treatment considerations for particular substances? For instance, if you have a patient who's continuing to drink certain medications that contribute to maybe some hyponatremia that we should be aware of, or ones that you would use with different histories. And then I'm kind of just throwing this in here, different medications that you treat with depression, with, for instance, like process addictions, like anything that works better with that.
Yes. Yeah, so to the first question in terms of treatment of patients who are continuing to drink or use substances, and I would throw into this category as well, those with multiple medical comorbidities. So the more medical comorbidities that we have along with the depression, the more careful we have to be about how we're using the antidepressants, particularly as you get older. So if you're looking at someone who's over the age of 65, for example, and may have a lot of medical comorbidities and is continuing to drink heavily, that's going to be someone that I go very slow in my dose increases. I really look at medications that have the best side effect profiles. We will probably be doing periodic lab checks and making sure that they're not hyponatremic to make sure there's nothing else that we need to be looking for. Oh, well, I'm really working with that patient to cut back on their alcohol because, frankly, I can give somebody a lot of antidepressants, but as long as they're drinking, we're not going to see the benefits and the effects. Same is true for psychotherapy. It's very difficult to engage in psychotherapy and get benefit if you're drinking heavily. You don't have to be completely abstinent, but can we actually reduce that down to a level where, you know, it's not as psychoactive perhaps as when you're drinking those higher levels? Now, to your other question around process addictions, that's an interesting question. And frankly, the depression and process addictions is a big comorbidity that we're just beginning to understand. We do know that for process addictions, there may be a role for naltrexone that blunts some of the benefit, the euphoria people experience from gambling or sexual addictions, even eating disorders as well, that can be of some help, especially bulimia. So we're beginning to understand a bit of how naltrexone works for those process addictions, but the underlying depression we would treat just the same as we would for anyone else. I tend to be more aggressive in those circumstances, maybe move a little faster on those dose increases, maybe move to different medication a little more quickly, really look at more potent treatments as well, because again, that comorbidity is so strong. And in my experience, it's very difficult to get a handle on that process addiction when there's depression in the background.
That's great.
Darlene, I was going to ask about duration of treatment. So can you tell us what the literature advises us in terms of duration of treatment for people?
This is always a really interesting question that patients bring up as well, because there's a variety of different ways to look at this. The first piece of this that I look at is once we've stabilized someone's depression and they're on a treatment regimen that is working, what are the side effects the person is living with at that point? So we all know we may live with side effects because the depression that we might experience is so much worse than some of those side effects. But I really want to understand that with patients, like, what are you living with? What do you not like about this medication? Do you feel like you don't have the emotional reactivity you would like to have? Do you feel tamped down in terms of your, you know, emotional response to, say, a sad movie or something like that? What are all of those side effects you're living with? Because that's going to go partly into the equation about how long you need to be on the medication. The other piece is important to keep in mind is the severity of the depression initially. So if someone comes to me having been on 15 different medications, having had 30 episodes of depression, 10 suicide attempts, 5 hospitalizations, we land on a treatment that works, my recommendation is probably don't ever come off this as long as you can possibly stand it. Because we found something that worked after all of this time, the risk of the return of the depression is so severe that we really have to be on top of this in a way that maybe if it wasn't as severe, we wouldn't have to worry about that quite as much. So again, what are the risks of a return of depression? How difficult was it to stabilize? That will go into the equation a little bit. And then, of course, patient preference as well. Oftentimes, I will be treating someone and we get to the 2 or 3 year mark on an antidepressant. And they say, you know what? I really think I'm dying. I'm young and healthy. I'm not on any of their medications. I really want to stop this. And absolutely, we will honor that. We'll have a conversation about risks and benefits, but importantly, what to look for in terms of resuming that medication. That's for major depressive disorder. If we look at some of the other mood disorders like bipolar, totally different answer on that. Again, because the severity is really something that we have to really take into account. By the way, the other piece of this too is the relationship of any substance use and addiction as part of that recovery from depression as well. If someone found that actually getting into aggressive treatment for their depression really help them to stop drinking or stop using other substances, then again, I'm going to say, what is the risk of stopping the medication? What is the benefit of stopping the medication? And let's be real about kind of what those risks and benefits are. We think, we don't know for a fact, we think that most antidepressants are safe for very long-term use.
On that same line, depression with psychosis, what does that look like? What are your first treatments for the depression with psychosis? And then same thing, your length of treatment.
So depression with psychosis is very interesting because we have a couple of varieties of this. We have depression with psychotic features, which means that the psychotic symptoms only occur when someone is depressed. So again, that episodic nature of depression, the psychosis follows that. When someone's not depressed or in an episode, there is no psychosis. That's called a major depressive disorder with psychotic features. We also have something that's called schizoaffective disorder, which many psychiatrists really believe is not an actual diagnosis. It's not a firm, complete diagnosis, but the concept is actually useful, which is that we have a depression or other mood symptoms that exist independently of psychosis. So in other words, I could be fine from the mood end of things, but still psychotic by diagnostic criteria that is schizoaffective disorder, among a few others that we kind of think about as well. Treatment is very different for those two. Schizoaffective disorder is long-term antipsychotics, plus or minus an antidepressant, depending on the mood symptoms and the nature of the response. But basically, if you have schizoaffective disorder, which causes a ton of functional impairment, a lot of distress for the person, that's going to be lifelong treatment once we get that person stabilized. Depression with psychosis is an interesting one because historically, when I was trained, the training was an antidepressant plus an antipsychotic for life, basically. That was the instruction that we got. Turns out that that's probably not necessary, and you can probably get by with just an SSRI. You really don't even have to treat the psychosis because the nature of that psychosis is quite a bit different. Tends to be a little bit more delusional, tends to be a little bit more in a thought disordered realm, maybe paranoia as well. And there is evidence that you actually don't need to use antipsychotics to achieve full remission from that condition. I probably wouldn't do that. I still would use an antipsychotic just because I find it an effective treatment strategy for depression as well. But again, you can actually use just the monotherapy. And then again, the same kind of calculations going to the length of treatment. What was the severity? What were the functional impacts? Was there suicidal thinking? Were there suicide attempts and so forth?
Is there any other recommendations when you have co-occurring substance use disorders? And then age recommendations. What about our older patients with medications that you would use?
So let me start with the older patients first, because I think, one, we tend to under-recognize substance use disorders in the geriatric mm-hmm. population, particularly alcohol. I think that's one of the ones that really, increasingly, I'm really thinking about how do we do a better job of screening those patients, because we really need to look at the whole totality of holistic treatment with geriatric patients. We can use antidepressants very effectively, very safely with those over 65, 75. I think the oldest I've ever treated was 100 years old on antidepressants. Having said that, we know with geriatric patients that less is more, and that we really want to think about getting by with as little medication as we can. And oftentimes, if we can diagnose that alcohol use disorder or just unhealthy alcohol use in period and really address that first, the depression may get to a point where we can use psychotherapy approaches, very light, low-intensity antidepressant treatments, things of that nature, and avoid some of that polypharmacy that we all dread with those patients, for sure. And then in terms of the question around special considerations with substance use disorders, and treatment of depression, you know, I think it's one of those situations where you really want to think about what is driving the most functional impairment and distress for that patient. Is it both? Is it both the depression and the addiction or the substance use disorder? Or is one predominant over the other? And oftentimes what I will do, if one is predominant over the other, particularly if it's the addiction that's really driving a lot, you know, I may have them work on abstinence or get into whatever type of treatment and recovery makes sense for them. Well, we're kind of looking at some non-medical or non-interventional techniques with the depression, maybe using some of the self-help techniques that work for both conditions, finding therapists who are skilled in working with both conditions simultaneously. And then we kind of see where things go over time as they begin to address the alcohol use. So that goes into part of my initial assessment, really what is driving more functional distress. As I like to say, though, if both are driving the most functional distress, which is the more common situation, I really want to give that patient every single treatment that is safe and effective to give them the chance to really succeed and reach their goals. And oftentimes we can peel back stuff later, right? We can go 6 months or 9 months or a year later and say, hey, you've been really stable. Let's cut that Prozac out now that we started in your early abstinence. But I think really giving that person every opportunity possible and every treatment possible is really important.
No, I think that's really helpful. That's great. Thank you.
Turner, this is more classical psychiatry question, and you talked about it before when you're talking about severe major depressive disorders. But can you talk a little bit about treatment-resistant depression, especially since the treatment options seem to be broadening? And also, yes. I have a question too. How do you recognize treatment depression? I mean, intuitively, it's people who are failing multiple attempts, but is there an actual diagnosis or specific criteria for treatment-resistant depression?
Yes, I'll give you the answer based on our current nomenclature, which is basically that treatment-resistant depression is a type of major depression, typically severe, but it doesn't have to be, typically a severe major depressive disorder with failure of repeated attempts with various medications, typically. And typically, we define that clinically as a failure of either two or three different antidepressants across two different classes. So at least one SSRI, at least one SNRI. In practice, usually these patients come in having failed, or as I like to say, the treatment has failed, 10, 12, 15 different medications across multiple classes and combinations. So you will see various definitions of treatment-resistant depression based on whether it's a research study, based on whether it's a protocol for ketamine or what have you. But typically, these are patients with very severe recurrent depression that have failed multiple treatments across different classes. I do think that at some point, we will understand that treatment-resistant depression is a completely different type of depression. The character of it's different. It tends to be less episodic. The recovery between episodes is much shorter. The severity is worse. Even partial response to medications and other treatments that we use tends to be much less than we would expect. And it tends to be something that causes much more functional impairment and distress than even a related severity of depression that is not treatment-resistant. So I think at some point we're going to figure that out, and we'll find treatments that actually target those changes in the neural pathways that are responsible for those symptoms. Until then, what we tend to think of is that we tend to go for those patients, if they have not already tried beyond the standard SSRI, SNRI pathway. So we have a variety of third and fourth line agents, I think tricyclic antidepressants, monoamine oxidase inhibitors of a couple of different types, different and various combinations. And then importantly, interventions such as electroconvulsive therapy, which actually for the audience, I will just either remind people or let them know that electroconvulsive therapy is the most effective treatment for depression that we have, period, full stop. 80 to 85% of patients will respond to a course of ECT. The problem is that the depression tends to recur. And so you have to have some strategy to deal with those recurrences over time. But ECT tends to be a very important part of the treatment for these patients. And then increasingly, we're looking at ketamine, eventually psilocybin will probably be in this category as well. And then a variety of other interventions have been studied for the population as well.
Thank you. What's your opinion about the risk of using ketamine for this type of depression with people who have either a history of a substance use disorder or an active substance use disorder?
Yes, this could actually fill an entire podcast episode. Okay. And in fact, it's one of the questions that is only remarkably beginning to be studied, to be honest with you. To answer that question, I'll back up a bit about ketamine and describe ketamine just a bit. Ketamine is not thought to be a truly addictive substance when we look at how the substance works, how it works in the brain, what neural circuits it activates. It's not really thought to be an addictive substance at what I'll call reasonable doses. And the doses we use to treat depression are actually low doses. So I think when people use ketamine in a kind of a controlled environment under a physician's prescription or someone as part of anesthesia and what have you, very safe. The ketamine addictions that we see really are with massive doses used over long periods of time and often accompanied with other substances of abuse as well. So typically people don't just use ketamine. It's used with MDMA and cocaine and methamphetamine and other substances as well. So true ketamine addiction is actually pretty rare. And so I don't worry about people becoming addicted to the ketamine. What I worry about a little bit is that the sensation that one gets when you're treating with ketamine a major depressive episode. And what happens when we use ketamine to treat depression, we can use IV ketamine, which almost always results in a dissociative episode. We can use oral ketamine, which almost always does not, or we can use intranasal ketamine, which has some other properties that are a little bit concerning about how quickly that is taken up into the bloodstream. So typically with someone who has a very severe addiction who's in recovery, and really we want to treat that depression with ketamine because we know the depression also is a risk factor for using and a risk factor for their addiction, we may want to choose something that doesn't have as much of a quote-unquote high as that IV ketamine. And I have run into patients before who have actually really enjoyed that high from the IV ketamine that have that history of being in recovery from alcohol for 10 years or what have you. So again, we may choose the oral ketamine or something that actually doesn't have those same side effects and symptoms in order to minimize the risk of a return to use. Again, not abusing ketamine, but returning to use of alcohol or another substance.
Mm-hmm. Patients all the time who ask me about the appropriateness of ketamine treatment for themselves and whether or not they really meet criteria for treatment-resistant depression. And of course, the majority of my patients have a substance use disorder. So it's going to be interesting to watch this field emerge and to see, you know, how we can better treat these folks and also protect their more vulnerable, you know, histories. So that's very interesting. Thank you.
I wish we had more research on that topic, to be honest with you. But the research we have on ketamine is actually not great to begin with. We have some good evidence around its use, but it's all over the place. Different formulations, different dosages, different lengths of administration, different episodes between administrations and so forth. So it's hard to make sense of a lot of the ketamine literature.
So do you find that the same thing is happening with ketamine treatment as it is with ECT in terms of the duration of the effect is time limited? And what are you seeing clinically with that? And do people just need to get, you know, maintenance ketamine then, or what's the plan?
Yeah, you know, with ketamine, it is very similar to ECT in certain respects. Although in my experience, again, there's not a lot of research on this topic. In my experience, there can be a waning of effect with ketamine over time that you don't see with ECT. Once ECT works, it tends to continue to work even with monthly maintenance treatments. But ketamine does actually work with maintenance treatments as well. And oftentimes we can prolong that initial response. However, oftentimes we need to add in additional medications to prolong that response. And there's been a lot of study around what those medications should be, what receptors do we want to target, which ones do we want to avoid that might actually shorten the response. But the vast majority of people that use ketamine will see a recurrence in about a month after actually having a response within about 24 to 48 hours. So again, we have to manage that and those expectations and then understand how we lengthen the duration of treatment. And there are probably 6 or 7 or 8 different ways that we've figured out to actually lengthen the treatment, just depending on the patient's preferences. Could be maintenance treatments with IV. It could be a switch to oral ketamine, which they can take either in a supervised setting or as take-home troches as well. So there are various ways we can actually manage that. And all of them have risks and benefits and pros and cons.
Thank you. Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you consider seasonal affective disorder part of this kind of classification of depressive disorders? And because we always see a lot of this, especially this time of year, people self-diagnosed, or we can identify that people certainly have a seasonal pattern to their mood symptoms.
Yes, for sure. Seasonal affective disorder, which is actually just depressive symptoms related to the season. So again, just symptoms kind of at the height of darkness in the winter, that actually does occur. What's much more common, though, is exacerbation of underlying depression based on the seasons. And so as you move into the winter months, especially in Utah, where it seems like it gets dark at 4:30 in the afternoon in, you know, January and December, right? People do see a recurrence of depression. They may find that they're not engaging as much activated behaviors, like getting out and exercising or going out with friends and that kind of thing because of the darkness. And then we can see a worsening of the depression. Those are two separate issues, though.
But that's good to know, because then that, I don't know, in my mind, that maybe changes your treatment approach for people in terms of like monitoring their depressive symptoms all year round, and then just with special attention to the winter months and trying to keep them more active, or kind of psychoeducation around how symptoms might change in the winter.
That's right. And also just behavioral issues around how you handle the darkness, right? So in the morning, if you're used to getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning during the summer, maintain that schedule in the winter, but make sure that you have exposure to bright light immediately when you get up in the morning. There's been a lot about light boxes that's been written and looked at over the years. And yes, those do serve an important function for many people. However, just actually looking at your environment and how you turn on lights in the morning and how you get light exposure in the morning can be helpful.
That's great advice. I really like how you talk so much about just the lifestyle factors when it comes to treatment for depression. And I think that gets underutilized. Sometimes we get so caught into this where the patient's here, so I must prescribe them a medication. But I really appreciate that you're, for the first, I guess the best way to say it, your first two tiers for depression, it's really what we're talking about is therapy and lifestyle changes, and they have the most effective evidence behind them. So I think that's really important to point out. But that's also what we see in the recovery environment for our patients, the same. So,
and I think that's one of the lessons that I've learned, at least for myself, from my work in treating substance use disorders. We actually focus a lot on lifestyle modifications and early abstinence and recovery. And that's really, really useful, I think, down the line, right? We don't do as much of that with our patients who come in with depression and other psychiatric concerns. And I think the more we can think about those lifestyle factors for everyone, recognizing that for some, that will be sufficient, but everyone will benefit from it. So that's kind of the way that I approach that. And again, we could have a whole podcast on lifestyle modifications specific to depression, but they really come into some pretty basic categories, which is don't sit on the couch and binge watch Netflix, right? Do something that's activating, get out with a friend, go for a walk, try to take advantage of those precious daylight hours in the winter and really get out into nature and see something beautiful. Those kinds of things that really help you to feel better, that really does help quite a bit.
And I'm sure you talk about sleep all the time too, because you talked about exercise, connection, you know, activity, but and then sleep. And that's what we talk a lot about our folks in early abstinence about, is getting on a regular sleep schedule. But that seems to be a big modifier for depression as well, doesn't it?
It is. And I think we see the opposite sometimes with depression that we might see with substance use disorders, which is really sleeping too much and staying in bed for 12 or 14 hours a day. And oftentimes when I'm talking with patients about those particular modifications, it's one, let's look at your sleep to see whether we need to treat some aspect of insomnia. And there, again, various ways to treat that. But do we need to treat some aspect of insomnia? But then once we sorted that out, let's figure out how to get you out of bed after 8 hours of sleep and not staying in bed all day, because that also is a vicious cycle that's very difficult to emerge from.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
That's great. Well, Dr. Turner, I could just keep picking your brain all night. I appreciate all your wisdom. Thank you so much. Is there anything else that we haven't covered?
I think I would just come back to what I said toward the beginning, which is that if you have depression, if you actually are feeling physical symptoms, you feel like there is no hope, it's really important to know that depression is one of our most treatable psychiatric conditions. You may have to hang in there with us for a minute to figure out what's going to work the best for you, but please seek help. Please talk to someone about what's going on and come in and get an evaluation and assessment to figure out what is the right treatment plan for you.
Thank you. I don't think we could say it better.
That's right. Thank you so much. Thank you. That was so interesting. I learned a lot. I appreciate it.
Oh, great. That's always good whenever I can teach some physician things. That doesn't always happen.
Really excellent. So great. Thank you very much.
It's a great topic.
Until next time, hey, check us out at theaddictionfiles.com or email us at theaddictionfiles@gmail.com. Thank you so much to Ricky Valades for use of his song Awake. Check him out at rickyvalades.com.
Purposes only. Hosts and guests are not responsible for any harm caused by information obtained from this source. As each person is unique, you're advised to seek the advice of your own healthcare professional to treat any medical conditions you may be having. Opinions expressed on the show are those of the Addiction Files and not of our respective employers.